Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are about to have a conversation with Annie Leonard, who created The Story of Stuff, a short film of stick figures that ended up having 10 million viewers and people all around the world following it, listening to it, watching it, talking about it, using it in their classrooms and study groups. She's the author of a recent book based on that film and, of course, directs The Story of Stuff project. And Annie Leonard, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
It's great to be back.
And we're looking forward to having you back live in studio in June.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So we're going to get a lot of you this year.
Yes.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Do we have clips for the story of stuff? Let me play a little thing from the top of your the film to give people a sense of it. Then let's leap into the heart of it and talk about some of the people who critiqued it and hear what Annie Leonard has to say.
Now, perceived obsolescence convinces us to throw away stuff that is still perfectly useful. How do they do that? Well, they change the way the stuff looks. So if you bought your stuff a couple of years ago, everyone can tell that you haven't contributed to this arrow recently. And since the way we demonstrate our value is contributing to this arrow, it can be embarrassing. Like, I've had the same fat white computer monitor on my desk for 5 years. My coworker just got a new computer. She has a flat, shiny, sleek monitor. It matches her computer, it matches her phone, even her pen stand. She looks like she's driving in Spaceship Central, and I look like I've got a washing machine on my desk. Fashion is another prime example of this. Have you ever wondered why women's shoe heels go from fat one year to skinny the next to fat to skinny? It's not because there's some debate about which heel structure is the most healthy for women's feet. It's because wearing fat heels in a skinny heel year shows everybody that you haven't contributed to that arrow as recently, so you're not as valuable as that person in skinny heels next to you, or more likely in some ad. It's to keep us buying new shoes.
That was just a little clip from Annie Leonard's Story of Stuff. You can't get the real flavor of it unless you watch it, which you can do as we're talking about going to the website and going to Story of Stuff and seeing what we're talking about. Annie, let's talk a bit about the history of this. And you spent years, if I remember right, working for Greenpeace.
That's right. But my interest actually even started before that. My interest started when I lived in New York City in the late 1980s, and I was just fascinated by the huge piles of garbage that were just constantly on the street. And I started wondering, what is in all of those bags, and where is it going? And that inspired me to go do something which I encourage everyone to do, which is go visit the local dump. It is a fascinating way to get a new perspective on your city. So I went to the Freshkills landfill, which was where New York City's garbage was going then, and just stood there and looked out at as far as I could see, just waste. There was appliances and furniture and shoes and pizza boxes and books, and it was almost like a bolt of lightning striking me in terms of just figuring out what my life purpose was. I was like, how could we have built an economy that was just based on such a complete destruction of natural resources, and why was it so hidden out of view? So I decided to figure it out. So I then went to Washington, D.C., worked for Greenpeace and some other groups, and I spent over 10 years traveling the world looking at the factories where our stuff is made and the dumps where our stuff is dumped. And everything I found out in those years, I summarized in The Story of Stuff.
And your story of stuff really is the story of this material economy, and you go through extraction, production, distribution, consumption, disposal. You have these figures up in the back of your on the screen as you're describing it. And so talk a bit about that, your theory about that. I want to ask some questions to people I've read in the last few months since we talked last who have kind of critiqued some of the things you said.
Sure. Well, what I looked at is the materials economy, and as you said, the different stages, so extraction, where we do the mining, where we fell the forest or grow the crops or harvest the ocean, wherever we get this stuff from, to production, which is where we use energy and toxic chemicals and mix it all together to make the products, to distribution, where we ship all this stuff all over the world, to consumption, where we use the stuff up. That's really short, that phase. And then to disposal, where we dump it all out. And the film, while I'm talking with the sound that you just heard, there are these very cute animated cartoon figures in the back. And the reason I chose that is to try to make this topic more accessible and engaging. I personally am a total wonk, and I love reading these really, really technical reports about the materials economy. But I realized most people don't. And so I tried to figure out, is there a way to make it simple without dumbing it down? Like, I wanted to tell the whole truth and say it like it is, but just do it without the guilt and the technical jargon and the sort of scolding flavor that a lot of this anti-consumption work has in it.
So now, when you put these things together, and I mean, they're pretty compelling, and you, as we said, over 10 million people have used and watched this. around the world, and I've heard, though some people, one person I know who used it in a classroom said to me that people were upset because it's nothing but an anti-capitalist rant, that you are just ranting against our consumer-based society and who we are and kind of accusing all Americans of being greedy and selfish, and that's the way we live our lives.
Well, actually, I do not think Americans are greedy and selfish at all. I really believe in the fundamental goodness of all of us, and I think it's the system that brings this kind of behavior out in us. I don't think any of us wake up and, you know, rubs our hands together and says, gee, how can we poison children and trash the ocean today? But I think we have a system that unfortunately rewards environmentally destructive behavior. But in terms of the anti-capitalism piece, that is so interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I set out to make this film, nowhere on my horizon was the idea of critiquing capitalism. I wasn't even thinking about it. What I just wanted to do was share with people what I had seen in all these years of visiting factories and dumps. I know most people don't get to go to China and Pakistan and South Africa and see where stuff comes from and where it goes. So I just wanted to share it. My goal was to get people to think a bit more critically about where all their stuff comes from and where it goes. So when people first started saying that it was anti-capitalism, which took about a year after it was already out and widely distributed before some Fox News commentators got on that bandwagon and started saying it was anti-capitalist, I said, what part of it is anti-capitalist? Is the part that's critiquing capitalism the part where I say we shouldn't have neurotoxins and reproductive toxins in our products? Or is it the part where I say workers and communities shouldn't be considered disposable and be poisoned? Or is it the part where I say, you know, rich people should not be given more say than poor people? Because if what they're saying is all of those things are anti-capitalism, then I think they're bringing up some really good points about there's some flaws in capitalism. Let's talk about them. Let's get them on the table.
Well, maybe could it be the chubby guy at the top of the with the top hat and a dollar sign on his chest?
Yeah, there's been some complaints from those Fox News guys about the line where it says it's the government's job to take care of us. So I want to make sure that the viewers realize I don't mean to floss our teeth and tuck us in bed at night. I'm not talking about a patronizing, fatherly kind of government like that. What I mean by take care of us is I mean make sure that things are safe and clean and fair. I mean, I think it is the government's role to make sure that children's toys do not have neurotoxins and reproductive toxins and carcinogens in them. I think that is the government's job to make sure that our transportation is safe. There absolutely is a role for government. Some of these people have pushed back and said, you know, it's really up to individuals to take responsible action. So I'll just offer myself as an example. I am about as neurotically vigilant as one could be to protect myself and my family about toxins. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm so neurotic about it, I would not wish upon anyone else this level of neuroses. In my house, there is no PVC, no Teflon, no BPA, no BFRs. Like, it's ridiculous. It's not a good way to live. Yet I had my own body burden tested for this book to analyze what toxics are in my body. Even though I spend extra money on organic food, even though I do all this, my body is loaded with dozens and dozens of toxic chemicals, stuff that I did not voluntarily bring into my life. So there's a certain level of things that we can't solve at the individual lifestyle choices. We really need government action. So instead of teaching every parent how to scour the different online databases so that they can make sure that their children's shampoo doesn't have carcinogens in it, just say no more carcinogens allowed in children's shampoo. Get the toxics out. We need a responsive, health-oriented government.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. We're talking with Annie Leonard, who created the Story of Stuff. You can see it on our website, steinershow.org. You can go to Story of Stuff right away and see what she did there. It's a 20-minute video that is used around the country and around the world to address the way we live our lives and what we do with stuff, where we get it, where it goes. And she has created a whole new series of videos that I have just begun to watch at the Story of Stuff, which is the story of electronics, the story of cap and trade, and the story of bottled water. 410-319-8888. A couple of quick things, Annie. Some of the critiques, and I didn't raise these the last time we spoke because I kind of, in many ways, obviously think a great deal similarly to the way you do and what you talk about. But then some of the critiques raise things like, well, she's out there scaring us. She's scaring us because she says that 50% of our tax dollars go to the Defense Department, which is why some of my friends, as you say in the thing, say I should put a tank instead of a person representing our government, but you want it to be the people. And because the government says, no, we only spend 25% of our budget on defense. So how do you respond to that?
Well, there's a footnoted and annotated script on the website.
There is.
And Yeah, and so people can, it's lengthy, it's extremely long. It explains where it got every fact in the film, and it also provides extra information or analysis to help understand those facts. And with some of the facts and figures, it does depend how one calculates it. And so what I did is I chose organizations or institutions who I trusted their politics, I trusted their science, I put those up there. People are welcome to look at it. If they choose to use a different organization in their estimate, they're certainly welcome to do that. Often it really depends upon the definition. Like, for example, one of the one of the facts that's gotten a bunch of critique is the part where I say we have 4% of our original forests left. And Glenn Beck has responded and said, actually, forested area is increasing in many places in the United States. And that's true, but he's talking about plantations. Plantations are not the same ecologically as a natural forest. They don't provide the same kind of services in terms of water, hydrological cycle moderation. They don't have the same kind of biodiversity and wildlife habitat. They tend to use much more pesticides and have much more erosion. A plantation is not the same thing as a forest from an ecological perspective. But if you're just talking about land that has trees in it, you know, and you're not very discerning, you could say they are the same thing. So, you know, it really depends on how you look at some of those statistics. All my statistics are cited for and explained on the website. But furthermore, even if one disagrees with a couple of the sources on the site, I don't think it takes away from the big picture, which is that overall we are using too much stuff, we are using too toxic stuff, and we are not sharing it fairly. And that those are absolutely undisputable.
So let me ask you where you this conversation goes and where you think we take society. I mean, if in fact, again, I've seen some other conservative right-wing arguments to say that, you know, America, as you put it, with 5% of the population, use 30% of the world's resources. And then somebody can counter and say, yeah, but America creates 30% of the world's resources.
How are we creating 30% of the world's resources? We're getting our oil, we're getting our wood, we're getting our metal, we're getting everything we need from other places.
So we're
creating 30% of the garbage.
So tell me, Annie, where do we go? I mean, what when you go beyond the critique, and go beyond, I've just begun to watch your cap and trade thing, which I'm dying to finish watching. But when we go beyond the critique, where do we go with this? I mean, where and how do we build a place? Since we're such a consumer-oriented society, we all live in our cars, we all live in our computers, we all live, you know, every time I pick up the cell phone now, I start thinking about how many people have died in the Congo to let me have this bloody cell phone. And so, but I use it, and I can't get away from it. And so, well, maybe I can, but I can't, you know what I'm saying? where do you think we go with this? I mean, what's the next step of where we begin to confront ourselves and the society about what this means?
Well, gosh, there's a lot of things in that statement I want to respond to. First,
go ahead, take your time.
Feeling bad about the cell phone is I am not against stuff. I have a cell phone too, and I use it constantly, and I appreciate it. I am not against stuff, and I don't think we should feel guilty about having our stuff. But what I'm actually is for stuff. And I want people to have greater awareness about what it took to make and just get them their stuff. I want people that when they look at their cell phone or when they look at their whatever it is, whatever product it is they have, to really have reverence and appreciation for somebody mined those metals, somebody felled that forest, somebody worked at that factory to make you this, somebody shipped this to you. There was a lot of effort and energy and materials that went into getting us all our stuff. And so instead of feeling guilty about it or instead of, you know, mindlessly chucking it, let's just slow down the flow of this stuff in our lives and have a bit more appreciation and reverence for all that went into getting us our stuff. So don't feel bad about your cell phone. Just keep it and cherish it, and don't chuck it just because a new one's going to come out with a better speakerphone or a more fancy camera. You know, keep it as long as possible. So that's one thing I really want to get across. I'm not anti-stuff. I'm for stuff. The other thing about where we're going to go is that we have a couple of really good things on our side. One is that we are going to have to change. We're no longer at a point where we have to appeal to people's, you know, sense of morality or environmental awareness in order to convince them that we have to change. We are across the planet now bumping up against ecological limits. We are not going to be able to continue to consume at this rate, so change is inevitable. Right now, globally, we're using 1.5 planet's worth of resources each year. That means the amount that the planet can regenerate each year, we're using 1.5 of that each year. The only reason we're allowed to do that is, or that we're able to do that, is because we're eating into into the stockpile that's built up over eons. But you can't use 1.5 times your, basically your income, or 1.5 times the planet's regenerative capacity. You can't use 1.5 times indefinitely when you only have one planet. So change is inevitable. To me, that's an enormous sort of spring of hope, because we're going to have to change. The question is, are we going to change by design, or are we going to change by default? And that's where all of us have a say. If we change by default, you know, if we dig our heels in and say the American way of life is non-negotiable, and even though we're 5% of the population, we're allowed to have 30% of the resources, it's going to be really ugly. It's going to be violent. It's going to be unjust. It's going to be ugly. If we, however, take the initiative, if we're strategic and intelligent and compassionate and change by design, we can be so much better about it. And there are so many ways we can do it. Lots of people ask me, how can I be so optimistic, even knowing the incredibly depressing data about the state of the planet? And the reason I'm so optimistic is that I know there are so many ways we can do it better. I hang out with these green industrial designers who are figuring out how to make everything from electronics to transportation to entire cities modeled after nature. They call it biomimicry. And green chemists who are actually designing new materials from the molecular level so that they are inherently safe and compatible with ecological systems. I mean, it is just fabulous, this different kind of future that's not even, you know, some abstract thing in the future. People are already working on it now. So I am full of hope that we can do this.
We're talking with Annie Leonard here in this first part of our program at 410-319-8888. She is the woman who created Story of Stuff. You can check that out on our website, or go right to Story of Stuff yourself on the web and see what we're talking about. I mean, we also, though, live in a world, you know, this is And there's a duality with everything here. You go to Copenhagen, and there are 100,000 people from every continent, from countries across Asia, Africa, Latin America, North America, South America, and Europe, that represent communities of color and working-class communities across the world, saying enough is enough.
Right.
On the other hand, you have people in those societies and our own who are in those societies saying, clamoring, we want what they have. Why should... I want that car. I want that air conditioner. We all want that same level of living. I mean, we have a real contradiction on the planet here. On the one hand, we know we only have a limited supply of stuff, of resources to use for everybody on it. On the other hand, we've created a world where the consumerist passion, the consumerist addiction is a way of life and a dream of almost everyone who lives here on this earth.
Right, and we're certainly stoking that dream. You know, I've worked a lot on stopping the export of hazardous waste from the U.S. to third world countries, and I've worked on stopping the export of hazardous products and hazardous technologies. But I actually think the most dangerous thing that we export is this toxic-laden, consumer-crazed way of organizing your society. And it is just relentless how we bombard other countries with the message that this is the way to happiness. I have a couple thoughts on that. One is that, fair enough, people want transportation and, you know, a device to listen to music and a device to be able to communicate with their friends and colleagues. Fair enough, and they should be able to have it. I'm, as I say, not against people having transportation and music and phones, but what I'm saying is that that shouldn't have to poison the planet and people. We can make these things. We can make them green. We can make them safe. We can make them last. There is no reason that our transportation modes have to destroy the climate. There is no reason that our little music devices have to contain reproductive toxins and neurotoxins. And actually, in fact, it's very interesting to compare the standards in the United States and Europe. Europe has taken much more protective measures that says that a whole range of toxic chemicals have to be out of electronics and out of personal care products. They're just not allowed. Yet those very same companies are still making stuff for the United States that have those toxic chemicals. So if they say to us, oh, we don't know how to do it, it's like, are they nuts? They think we can't find out what's happening in Europe? Just get the toxics out. So I'm all for people having stuff, but stuff that does not harm the planet, poison the workers, and poison the consumers. The other thing is that there's an interesting relationship between happiness and stuff. And this has been looked at on numerous studies across cultures, across age groups, across economic status. And what you see is that the relationship between stuff and happiness grows together for a while. That at a certain point in your stuff accumulation process, more stuff is linked with greater happiness. You know, having a roof over your head, having some art and leisure activities, having education, having a doctor to go to when you're sick. You know, all those things increase increase your happiness. But there's a point at which these things start to diverge, and more stuff does not actually increase our happiness. More stuff actually becomes a greater burden, and that's where most of us in the United States are right now. We have made getting, maintaining, replacing all of our stuff such a high priority that we are working longer hours than in any other industrialized country, except maybe South Korea. It depends what data you look at.
Mm-hmm.
We are spending more time watching TV than people in any other country, and more time shopping than in any other country. And all of the time that we're putting into that whole culture of stuff is time that we have taken away from putting into our health. We now have 1 in 3 people obese. It's time that we've taken away from spending with our families, getting to know our neighbors. 60% of the people in the United States say they don't know their neighbors because they're too busy. So we're actually undermining the kind of things that provide real happiness and real security on this quest for ever more stuff, which not only doesn't make us happy, but it's also trashing the planet.
Annie Leonard is with us, at least for the next few minutes. She'll be back with us in June when she comes to the area. We can spend more time talking to her about her ideas then, but you can still join us here at 410-319-8888. I'm also very curious about these, if I can just digress for a moment, about these new projects you're working on. You seem to be now on a roll here creating these new films, these new things on cap and trade, on bottled water. Tell us a bit about that, these new efforts you're working on.
Sure. Well, the story of Cap and Trade was a little bit different than the rest of the ones we're going to be making because we really felt like that was a political emergency. What happened there is that a number of environmental and social justice activists from other countries came to us and they said, we need your help. They said the story of stuff has gotten quite a bit of attention, and the story of stuff has been able to take a very complicated issue and break it down to a real user-friendly way so that more people could engage in the conversation. And what they were worried about was that the number one leading proposal for dealing with climate, both in the U.S. as well as internationally leading up to Copenhagen, was actually a huge disaster, what they call a false solution. They said it's not going to work, yet the debate about it has been really stifled by its main supporters, which include the big oil and coal companies, as well as some of the Washington, D.C. environmental organizations. So they asked if we would help make a film to sort of popularize and open up the discussion. And that was a really interesting project because before I made the film, I called up a whole bunch of environmental groups who I knew really well. I said, I'm thinking of making a film that critically examines cap and trade. And I said, what do you guys think about the cap and trade approach to dealing with the climate? And across the board, every single person I talked to said, it will not work. It does not meet the science. It disproportionately benefits the big polluters, but it's the best we can get. And so I started questioning, what is this the best we can get mentality? I said, you're confusing political reality with physical reality. I said, let's demand something that works, that prioritizes the people, not the big companies, that matches the science. And I don't really know why people were unwilling to do that. I worry that the last couple of presidencies have sort of beaten the sense of political possibility out of us and that we've forgotten how to dream big. So even though it really caused them, it irritated a lot of big environmental groups, we made this film, The Story of Cap and Trade, that explains some of the inherent flaws in the cap and trade legislation. The reason that was a little different is it was really like a specific political intervention in that political debate. The other films that we're making are going to do the same thing, but about broader issues. So we have one that's coming up March 22nd. It's called The Story of Bottled Water. It's really good. It's about manufactured demands and how companies get us to buy something as ludicrous as water in a bottle. The next one will be The Story of Electronics, and it's about planned obsolescence, about how companies make electronics that are not only loaded with toxics but designed to break and be replaced as fast as possible. We have other ones coming up on the story of personal care products about all the toxic chemicals that we're putting in our bodies every day, and then the story of credit cards and debt and the story of subsidies. And one that I'm really looking forward to is the story of corporations that is going to be talking about the recent Supreme Court decision.
So, I mean, well, there's so much more to talk about. We only have like a minute or two left. But I just going back to where we began, when I talked about when they said being anti-capitalist. I mean, but there is something to that. I mean, for us to sit here and say that capitalism or corporate capitalism on this planet is not a huge part of the reason we're facing all the stuff we're facing is like putting our heads in the sand.
Absolutely. I think that people even put their heads in the sand even if they do think that, because it is almost like it's taboo to talk about it in this country. In the book, one of the things I said is it's the economic system which must not be named. It's like we're not even allowed to bring up the word or talk about it. I feel kind of like if our country was an ice cream store and the ice cream store only served one flavor, and you know that flavor is just not really working for me, so I just want to ask, do you have any other flavors? Are any other flavors working anywhere else? Like, can I just look over the counter and see, is there anything else? Can we talk about this? But you're not even allowed to wonder if there's an alternative. You know, so it drives me nuts. And I was thinking about capitalism was invented hundreds of years ago at the same time that bloodletting and leeches were considered the height of medical prowess. Imagine if we had refused to provide a critical reflection on medicine. Imagine if anyone who said, what's working and can we make it better, was ostracized the way you are if you discuss capitalism. I'm just saying, can we put it on the table and analyze it the way we analyze other things to try to make them better?
Well, we could always, you know, if things twist, but you can always, Annie, just go on the show and do this as a stand-up. Annie Leonard, thanks so much. We look forward to seeing you in June.
Thanks for having me. Me too.
Take care. Bye-bye. Annie Leonard has been our guest for the first part of this program, Story of Stuff. Go to their website, check it out. We'll be talking about her book in June and the other projects coming out, and look forward to doing that when she gets here next. And, folks, we're going to take a very short break and come back, and we're going to be joined by Sherilyn Eiffel, who just wrote a piece in The Root this morning about the closing of the Civil Rights Division in the Department of Justice that's investigating the cold cases and of these people who were murdered during the Civil Rights Movement at the height of segregation and racism in the South. We're also joined by Paula Johnson, who's professor of law at Syracuse, and she's co-director of the Janice McDonald Cold Case Justice Initiative at the Syracuse College of Law. Stay with us for that. We'll be right back. Remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. In this month's issue, four teams of collaborators explore four very different visions of the city. It's the Urbanite issue, a special annual issue devoted to showcasing outside-the-box thinking from Baltimore's most creative minds. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations, and you can visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a list of drop locations, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, a woman who's a frequent guest on the show and a dear friend, Sherilyn Eiffel, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, and author of the book on the courthouse law and confronting the legacy of lynching in the 21st century, who writes a great deal in many places, Baltimore Sun, The Jurist, and The Root. In The Root today, she wrote a piece called FBI Shuts Down Civil Rights Era Investigations. When we come back from this very brief break, let's take you to WEA Traffic. We're going to talk to Sherilyn Eiffel and Paula Johnson, who runs the Cold Case Justice Initiative at Syracuse College of Law. No traffic. All right. Oh, no traffic. I'm in the middle of the hour. I was told I was at the top of the hour again. Thank you. Zach said, Mark, look at the clock and know what time it is. So we'll go right to the conversation. And we're also joined by Paula Johnson, who is co-director with Professor Janice McDonald of the Cold Case Justice Initiative at the Syracuse College of Law and past president of the Society of American Law Teachers. And Paula Johnson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad I got that right. Sorry to keep you waiting. And and Sherilyn Eiffel should be here in a moment, I hope, joining us here as well.
Sure.
So Sherilyn wrote this piece, and it was brought to our attention this morning. One of our producers who read it and said, you know, this is pretty amazing. So let's talk about this. I mean, it's interesting how sometimes the early, mid-20th century, which I unfortunately or fortunately lived through and was part of, now meets the 21st century.
Yes.
Talk a bit about... First, let's take a step backwards. Let's talk a bit about the work you do at the Cold Case Initiative at Syracuse.
Excuse me. Professor Janice McDonald and I co-direct the Cold Case Justice Initiative at Syracuse University College of Law, as you mentioned. And we were approached by family members initially by the family members of Frank Morris, who was killed in 1964 when his shoe shop was set aflame in Faraday, Louisiana. And no suspects were ever brought, you know, before the justice system. And so his granddaughter asked us if we might be able to help them to get information, essentially, to get answers as to what happened and who might be responsible for her grandfather's death. And so we and our law students began to comb through documents and tried to search for the answers that had so far eluded the Morris family and apparently also law enforcement. And with that first case, then came others when, you know, other family members of those whose cases remained unsolved and were believed to be racially motivated began to approach us as well to see if we might be able to help them get answers which they had not received from any other sources. And so that, with that, our project really began because we, independently, as we began to do work and began to do research, we began to discover other cases that warranted further investigation. And so through those different sources, you know, our work effort grew to the point where we're handling a number of cases and trying to investigate them so that you know, the likelihood of accountability for causing these deaths, for causing these harms, and just for getting answers to some of these questions will result.
Now, I wonder if you know approximately, I mean, how many murders we're talking about that may have taken place in most of the South against Black folks in the Civil Rights Movement and others, and how many might still be outstanding?
Yeah, see, that's a very difficult question.
It's a tough question. Yeah, yeah.
You know, to answer with a definitive number or a finite number, there is a list, and it's a list that that the FBI and the Department of Justice have been working off of. That was generated by the NAACP, Southern Poverty Law Center, Urban League. You know, those principal groups. And that number was around, 100 or so cases. Now, you know, there is some play in the number because it's not altogether clear that all of those cases were indeed racially motivated. Now, at the same time, we're certain that even with that number that's being used, that underestimates the actual number of killings during the period that we're talking about, because so many folks are simply missing under suspicious circumstances, although their families believe that race was at the heart of what happened to them. So, you know, sometimes the deaths were suspicious and there wasn't a precise, you know, determination that was made. But again, you know, some of the circumstances surrounding either the disappearances or deaths that we're aware of or that family members are aware of lead us to believe that they, too, were racially motivated. So, you know, that's why it becomes difficult to give a precise number, but we're certain that we don't know the full scope of those killings that happened during the Civil Rights era.
Now, what we do know, when Cheryl and Eiffel wrote this piece this morning in The Root, announcing the FBI was, last week they were closing the office they have that investigates the cold cases that happened during the Civil Rights Movement.
Well, they didn't exactly say they were shutting down their office completely, but they did make a pretty astounding statement that that they had made a determination that they were only they only expected to bring a few cases to prosecution, and that they would be closing the rest. Now, the rest is the
vast majority
of the cases.
Mean?
And so that's very disturbing to us because, you know, we're concerned that some of these cases, of course, are over 40 years old. I mean, the Civil Rights era having, you know, been in the, you know, in the 1960s. So, you know, certainly the cases have some age to them. But there are questions as to just how thorough An investigation was conducted at the time of the killings and in the intervening years, such that the FBI would make a statement such as that to say that we are prepared to close most of the cases. We think that we need to investigate that proposition more fully, not only for the families, but also for the American public. And one of the things that we think would be in order at this point, I mean, to the extent that the FBI has made this declaration about the status of the cases, you know, we think that the public has a right to know how they reach those determinations. And the best venue for that to occur, the appropriate venue, rather than, say, the Washington Post or any other media outlet for that matter, would be in the halls of the United States Congress that has oversight responsibility for agencies and for the protection of the public. I mean, the Congress has the responsibility to make sure that everyone receives equal justice from all of the arms of the U.S. government, including law enforcement. So we would propose that that take place so that the family members for certain receive, you know, some answers from the FBI and the Department of Justice as to how they reached these conclusions and just where things are going to go. But this is a matter for the historical record as well. The American public deserves to have some of these questions answered, and that would be the best forum for us to get to the bottom of these decisions.
We're talking with Apala Johnson, who's professor of law at Syracuse University's College of Law, co-director of the Cold Case Justice Initiative at the Syracuse College of Law. And Sherilyn Ifill has just joined us as well. She is professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, author of the book On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, and wrote the piece today in The Root about the FBI saying it was closing down most of the search for the roots of the cases of murder civil rights workers in the South. Sherilyn, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
So one of the things, you know, when I looked at your article this morning, that and the list of people who have been convicted because of the efforts of the FBI and others, like Brian Dilla Beckwith, who killed Medgar Evers, Bobby Frank Cherry, who was responsible for killing the four girls in Birmingham Church in '63, Johnny Ford Seal, the Klansman who killed 19-year-olds Henry D. and Charles Moore. And the list goes on that besides the fact that these men who committed not just murder but acts of terror against fellow citizens were brought to justice, and this is a matter of just more than bringing people to justice, and you actually in your piece called out to a man that we both know who President Obama has appointed head of the Civil Rights Division, who had said in his quotes that we owe it to for justice and to others to keep this to keep this effort alive, to be asked by Congress why they're shutting it down.
Yeah, I mean it's you know, I have the highest regard for Tom Perez, who's the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, but I think that given what we know, you know, about his tremendous integrity and commitment to civil rights and his statement, and the fact that up to last summer, I can recall an article that appeared on CNN.com that, you know, in which it was, you know, speculated that the Department of Justice was looking at hundreds of these cases. And I even recall a kind of a call that went out from the Justice Department where different jurisdictions could identify, you know, cases from their jurisdiction that they wanted to the Justice Department to take up. This was all pursuant to the passage, the 2008 passage of the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crimes Act. And, you know, so that was just in 2008, and that act, you know, provided $10 million a year to the Justice Department. It anticipated providing that funding until 2017. So putting all of that together and then juxtaposing it with the story in the Washington Post, it just, to me, raises a lot of questions. It's very confusing to me to understand how, you know, Tom Perez, who I know gets these issues and understands the importance of the need for persistence, and, you know, together with the passage of the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crimes Act in 2008, an act that was co-sponsored by John Lewis, And, you know, the fact that there's this initiative and that it was speculated that the department was looking at hundreds of cases and so forth, how do we reconcile that with this statement in the Washington Post in which the FBI says, you know, we think we've got them, there's just a handful, but we're done? It just seems very strange.
Well, let's talk about why we're not done from your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
well, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, well, I mean, I think that it's important, and I say this in the piece, that it's not just about prosecuting perpetrators. And you know, Mark, this has been, you know, a theme for some time with me and one that I explore in my book about lynchings, that, you know, that truth is important also, that, you know, a lot of what has held these communities in the grip of a certain kind of terror is rumor and innuendo and not knowing and shame. And there's a lot we need to know. And what we need to know is not just the who did it, but we also need to know why didn't we know who did it before today?
Mm-hmm.
What was the nature of the investigation that local law enforcement engaged in, if they engaged in any? Who, if someone did, obstructed that investigation, those contemporaneous investigations? How effectively or efficiently did the FBI investigate in the cases in which they investigated contemporaneously some of these crimes? Because there are crimes that the FBI investigated, and some of those investigations are, you know, frankly, deeply problematic. So even those answers about, you know, who was not zealous in trying to bring justice in these cases, the communities have the right to have that information within the community and to try and understand and clarify what happened in their midst, because it wasn't just a period in which some extremists engaged in horrible acts. Extremists engaged in horrible acts with the complicity and sometimes the condoning by members of the community. And that's part of what the full revelation of these investigations can reveal also. So simply to say, you know, we think we've got them, but otherwise, you know, there's no more perpetrators out there. They're dead, or we can't figure out who they are, is not sufficient. What we need to know is the truth of what happened, including what did or what didn't happen in terms of law enforcement investigation.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Sherrilyn Ifill is with us, professor of law at the University of Minnesota School of Law, who wrote the piece in The Root today about the FBI saying they were winding down their look at investigating cold cases during the Civil Rights Movement. And Paula Johnson, who is really one of our national leaders in this area, who runs the co-director of the Cold Case Justice Initiative at the Syracuse College of Law. Number here is 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on whether or not it is time to shut this division down? This is really important for us to understand who committed these murders, how they were committed, what went on, why it went on 40 or 50 years after these took place. Many of the people who were involved are past, but it is our past very much living in our present. What are your thoughts? 410-319-8888 as we talk with Sherrilyn Ifill and Paula Johnson. And you can go to our website and connect to the piece that was written by Sherrilyn Ifill today on The Root, and also look at the work being done by Paula Johnson at the Cold Case Justice Initiative at Syracuse, 410-319-8888. So, we know that many of the people involved in this, as we said earlier, are probably dead or past.
Well, actually, Mark, if I could say something.
Paula, go ahead.
Here, we actually don't know that is the case in each of these instances. I mean, certainly, you know, with the passage of time, any number of people involved, both as perpetrators and victims, but also as witnesses, or just knowledgeable people, you know, may have passed on. But the point, and this was one thing that Sherrilyn said just a moment ago, and that I had mentioned before as well, and that is the question about the thoroughness of the investigation. In the Charles Moore and Henry D. case that you mentioned, for instance, his family, and principally his brother, Thomas Moore, who really spearheaded the investigation to make sure that those perpetrators would be brought to justice, was told by the official law enforcement agencies that James Ford Seal was dead. And when Thomas Moore went about the business of trying to find out for certain, to satisfy himself that the person who was responsible for his brother's death was in fact dead himself. He found the man living openly and notoriously, as we would say, in a trailer home. He yelled out to him, "Are you James Ford Seal?" And the man said, "Who wants to know?" Now, you know, when something like that happens, that's why we have to question whether all that could be done and all that should be done has been done in these cases that are still open.
Well, I wonder if either one would speculate. Sheila Neifel, starting with you. I mean, we have President Barack Obama in the White House, Eric Holder as Attorney General, other people like Tom Perez, who's now the new Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights and Justice, running this administration. Why do you and we have the bill passed, the TIL bill, as we talked about, $10 million a year till 2017 to investigate these cases. Why do you think this is happening?
I don't know. I mean, and that's why I'm saying, you know, as I said, I have a tremendous amount of respect and confidence in Tom Perez and Attorney General Holder.
Yeah, no, I respect him a great deal.
Yeah, so that's why I'm unwilling to speculate, but I am willing to say very clearly that they do need to explain themselves. And I think that Professor Johnson is right by saying, you know, we need some congressional hearings. We need the Judiciary Committee of the House, perhaps, and Representative John Conyers, perhaps, to convene some hearings. Let's have, you know, Tom Perez. Let's have the FBI special agent who's been assigned to this work, pursuant to the TIL bill, which authorizes the Criminal Division of the Civil Rights Division to identify someone in the FBI to kind of be the point person and the special agent. Let's have her come forward. Let's have Paula Johnson. Let's have people who worked on these cases. Let's try to understand where we are. Maybe the Washington Post article overstated it. And I just think the pain that these families have endured to read something like that so cavalierly in the Washington Post. And the other weird thing about the article, you know, the article kind of almost has an unfortunate tone to it. You know, it talks about some of the cases in which, you know, the black men who were killed in a bar fight or, you know,
right,
otherwise it wasn't a civil rights crime.
Someone died with his mistress and all the other stuff.
Yeah, they spent a lot of time on that. And so the tone of the article, and I don't attribute this at all to, you know, the Department of Justice, but the tone of the article, just, if I were a family member, it seems so painful to me. So I just think that we need an explanation. And as Professor Johnson says, it's not the kind of explanation that we want to read in the Washington Post. We owe it not only to the families, but to the communities where this happened. And to the United States, this is a history we have to grapple with. It's real. It affects how many of us as African Americans think about our relationship to law enforcement, think about our relationship to our neighbors. It is a truth that has to be told so that people cannot deny that these events happen. It is an important catalog of a period of domestic terrorism to happen in this country. I think we owe it to the American people to have those who were put in charge of this to come forward and explain, where are we? If we're ready to close this up, tell me why. What are we doing with these other cases? Is there going to be a database that will be readily accessible to the public where we can learn about the fruits of all of your investigations, including those that came to naught? Is this going to be on a website for the Justice Department? How do we get access to this information for the few handful of cases that you still say are under investigation? What is the status of them? Do we feel like we're closer to finding answers? How do you define a case becoming closed? Is it when you find a perpetrator? Is it when if the perpetrator is no longer alive, do you stop your investigation? I mean, these are the things I think we're entitled to get answers to, and we can only hear them from those who are, running this program. And for those people who fought very hard for the passage of the Emmett Till Act, I think it's really important to understand whether this act is going to yield the fruit that many of us hoped it would.
Let me open the phone and try to get a couple calls here before we have to move ahead and go to our next hour, because if you look at the numbers even they put out in the Washington Post, it would mean that 60-70 cases are still open that we don't have any resolution to.
So then why this announcement? I mean, like, it's just
right.
Weird.
410-319-8888. Hanif in Laurel, you're on the air. Hanif, you there? You're on the air. He's not there. Okay, we'll get these other callers in as we pop them up the line. Hey, Hanif, you there?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Ms. Jones, is that correct, Ms. Jones?
Johnson?
Professor Paula Johnson and Professor Sheldon Neifer.
Paula Johnson, yeah, you're asking all of the right questions. And I'm quite sure that there'll be some people who are probably listening at this show who are on whatever those committees are. I haven't read the article. But I think it's very important that all of those questions be answered. Like I say, to clear up a lot of the names, to make some amends between, you know, with the different racism and things that's been going on here in 2010. I think it's very important that this is resolved. And as you said, domestic terrorism is not a word that's defined by just a group of people of Arabian descent or Afghani descent or of any other descent in Arab country. There's been a lot of domestic terrorism right here. And I think those questions need to be answered because there's some people in some high places who probably were involved in, as you said, in many of these investigations that we need to know about, that we need to be aware of, so that, as you said, the families can feel comfortable. People can feel like the justice system is justice, which is very important. And I applaud you for your work and things that you're doing to advocate this cause. Thank you very much.
Lani, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. If I could say in
Paula Johnson,
I do want to thank the caller for that and say also how important Professor Eiffel's work is on these issues as well. And one of the things that she said a little earlier, which I think bears repeating, and that is this is not just about prosecutions. To the extent that the Department of Justice believes that there are cases that they can pursue in that direction, and of course we encourage that. But there are other aspects to this that also warrant being brought to light. For instance, in one case where there was a bomb placed under the driver's side of this victim's car, a man named Warless Jackson Sr. Clearly something deliberately done to cause his death. Now, the insurance papers officially listed his death as an accident.
Hmm.
Now, that's that bit of misrepresentation is also an injustice to the family, and that is not unusual, that when these kinds of events have occurred, they have been listed or classified as accidents. Now, there's nothing accidental about detonating a bomb under someone's car. What we don't know is who did that, but we know that that is not an accidental death. So those are the kinds of things that need to be brought to light so that the record is corrected.
We have to go to break here, and I want to thank both Paula Johnson and Sheldon Neifer for joining us, and I was going to say that we will contact our congressional delegations, members, to see what's going on, and if we can create a conversation here in the air between some of them and Professor Sheldon Neifer and Paula Johnson, we will, to see if we can't find out why and if there's going to be an investigation into what happened here. And Sheldon Neifer, thank you so much for the work you do and for what you wrote. And Paula Johnson, thank you so much for the work you do in trying to right the wrongs of the past that still are in our present.
Thanks for having
thank
me.
Thank you again.
It's
thank
good
you.
To have you both with us. And you can go to our website, steinershow.org, and connect to all of this and find out what's going on for yourself and connect to your local congressman, congressional representative, to say enough is enough. Let's not let this end until we know what really happened. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Hospital for Children, offering primary, specialty, and critical care for all children, from the smallest babies to the biggest teenagers. For more information or to learn about their specialty outpatient locations throughout the state, call 1-800-492-5538. We'll be right back. Stay with us.